This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
University Press of Colorado is pleased to announce Alan Sandstrom and Pamela Sandstrom's newest book, Pilgrimage to Broken Mountain, Nahua Sacred Journeys in Mexico's Huasteca Veracruzana. To Alan and Pamela, would you gift our New Books Network with a little bit more info about your background and research experience?
Yeah, I guess I'll start. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Nathan, for inviting us to this podcast. It's a real pleasure to be here. I am a cultural anthropologist and have spent, since 1970, many decades studying a single Nahua village in northern Veracruz, Mexico, and along with Pamela, who's right here. And most of our field work has been in Mexico among Native Americans, Nahuatl speakers. And but we did have a 6 or 7 month stay with the Tibetans in the Himalayas in the early 1980s as a kind of a break from our Mexico research. But we've been focusing mainly on this one particular culture, this one particular community in northern Veracruz, Mexico.
And Alan and I met shortly after he had spent a short stay in 1970 and a longer stay from 1972 to 73 in Mexico before we met. And then we met right when he returned from the field in 1973. And since then, we have been doing this work together. I was an art history major originally, but I discovered that anthropology sort of seemed like a larger framework. I became a librarian during the course of our collaboration and life together all these years. And I have my career was in academic librarianship and information science. So I think we made a good team. Alan always jokes you should marry a librarian.
Right.
What led you both to the topic of sacred journeys, and what do they represent for you in your academic career?
All right, that's a complicated question, but to simplify it a little bit, we are doing sort of a general study of social life and customs in this community. It's a community, by the way, of 600 people that when we first went there is 100 miles from the nearest paved road. And initially, 80% of the people didn't even know Spanish, but now probably 80% of them do speak Spanish. So we've been studying a number of things. We've published a lot on their different aspects of their lives. But one of the kind of mysteries that we were unable to get much information on was their religious system. We had attended dozens and dozens of rituals, cleansings, curings, dedications to the corn, to the maize, offerings to the sacred hills, all kind of things like that. But we were never quite able to put it all together. We interviewed people. We spent a lot of effort reading everything that anybody's written about it. But it wasn't until 1998 when they invited us to come. This is 28 years after beginning fieldwork there, by the way, that they invited us to come on a pilgrimage to a sacred mountain. And that's when we began to totally focus on the religious system.
And what about you, Pamela? Do you have anything to add?
Well, it's been a collaborative effort, that's for sure. When I came to the village for the first time in 1974, just for a brief visit, and then we came back many times after that, we've spent many years in residence, usually on a 12-month sabbatical leave, so that occurred fairly often, you know, often in our careers, often enough. It was definitely a collaborative effort, and it turned out that the focus on religion was really an ideal thing for us. Because interestingly, direct questions are rather considered rude. You don't get a good answer when you ask direct questions. So a long time and a lot of observation, very much like child rearing happens in a community like this, the Nawars don't go for long explanations. So it turns out that staying a long time, returning together as a couple, then later returning with our son, Michael, who enjoyed being in the village. It's a great world of freedom for kids. That turned out to be why we focused our attention. And then we will talk in a little bit, I hope, about the paper figures, the sacred paper cutting that the ritual practices center on.
Mm-hmm. How have scholars, either in anthropology or other disciplines, responded to your work thus far?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is the book is dated 2022. It was scheduled to come out. It did come out in January, but boy, there was a printing error. The book is a beautiful production by the University Press of Colorado, but they agreed and their printer agreed that it was a failure. It has 375 color photos, so they agreed to reprint, and the book did not come out again into our hands. It was released in late May. So the truth is, we just received yesterday our first review in a journal called Reading Religion, published by the American Academy of Religion. And that was a really nice and appreciated positive review. But the work that leads up to this book, as Alan will explain, has been, I think, very, very well received. The body of work that we've both contributed to, Alan wrote a book called Corn is Our Blood, and we think it's had a good impact. We'll talk more about that.
Yeah.
And so the region that you describe in Pilgrimage to Broken Mountain, where is it and why is it important?
Okay, it's in northeast of Mexico City, which is located up about in the center of the country. It's on the Gulf Coast, and it's in the Sierra Madre Oriental, the mountain chain that goes from approximately South Texas all the way almost to the Yucatan Peninsula. It's an extremely remote area. As I mentioned, there was no roads in it until fairly recently, and it took all day long to even get into the area. There's been very little anthropological work done in this region and none on the Nahua people themselves, even though they represent several hundred thousand people who live there. It's a tropical forest. It rains a lot. It gets extremely hot in the summer. And it is it's a difficult place to get around. It's very hilly. There's streams and rivers all over the place. So there's no bridges of any kind. There weren't any at that time. So it's very difficult to get around. And it discouraged people from engaging in long-term fieldwork there. So that was one of the attractions for us.
Pamela, was there an attraction that you wanted to mention?
They say the butterflies bite in the Washtenaw region, and I have to concur with that.
Okay. Why the year 1998 and not some other year? Was this the time that you just decided to go?
No, that's a good question. We had been going to the field on and off for years, and since 1970, as we mentioned earlier. But 1998, 28 years after the first fieldwork there, was the first time we were invited by a ritual specialist to join them on a sacred pilgrimage. So we did that in 1998, and since then we've been on 5 pilgrimages in total. And the pilgrimage is the most elaborate and of all of the ritual aspects of Nahua religion. And so we got to see a cross-section of the entire religion during this pilgrimage march, and all of the altars and the offerings that they made during it. And so we've spent the last 8 years, frankly, putting all this information together that we gathered on these 5 pilgrimages and writing this book.
You mentioned your son, Michael, but for the audience, who else accompanied you on this trip? Was it just your family, or did you have colleagues or friends that went with you?
That's a very good question. The field work we've done is it's Pamela and me, and then when Michael was born, we took him in to the field as often as we could. We're foreigners in Mexico. Obviously, we're North Americans. And so we wanted to incorporate as many Mexican students and other anthropologists as we could. So for each of these pilgrimages, we invited people from the University of Veracruz, which is in the Jalapa, Veracruz, the capital of the state of Veracruz. And so we had other anthropologists and students join us during most of these pilgrimages. Now, a lot of people wanted to come. We'd invite 10 or 12, but at the date of the pilgrimage actually arrived, things came up, and only about, between, say, 3 or 4 Mexicans actually joined us on each of these pilgrimages.
The one thing to add, too, that these are definitely organized by the ritual specialists in communities, and they attract people from all around the area, from other communities. There's a large network of kinship, families that are in different communities. So each one of these 5 pilgrimages that we participated in, and they were just a few of the constant round of ritual activity that goes on in this area. But we estimated and we counted usually as large a group as 70 people. Mm-hmm. So the ritual specialists, usually several of them, men and women alike, and a lot of their followers. So attracting a critical mass is a key job of a ritual specialist.
Mm-hmm.
What specific journey, sacred journey, in fact, did you take? Because from what I read, there were different sacred journeys that you could go on. So why was the journey that you went on special to you?
Well, I think the answer to that is that the object of the pilgrimage was a sacred mountain called Postecli. And Postecli means broken in the Nahuatl language. And what it is it's a volcanic core, a huge, gigantic volcanic core sticking straight out of the tropical forest over 2,200 feet high. And if you look for certain angles, it looks like the top is broken off of this huge rock. And so that's this Postecli is the key element in Nahua religion. It was inside of this rock that Korn and his twin sister hid from people and threatened starvation. And this is part of the myth system that we record, and you can read in the book. Eventually, the top of the mountain was broken off in order to free the corn and to save people. So we went on 2 pilgrimages to the top of Postecli, of this particular sacred mountain, and then 3 pilgrimages to lesser mountains. So I would say the trip we took to the top of Postecli was the key experience.
One thing to add, I think, about the story of this particular mountain, Postecli, it's a very well-known location to other cultural groups throughout. There may be some connection even in the Popol Vuh to the same story. It's probably a part of indigenous oral narrative in Mexico that's widely shared, but this is a rather spectacular spot. So one of the way we organize the book is to tell the stories about the story of Korn. So we report kind of a composite or amalgam of 5 sacred myths, starting with the story of Korn, to explain the reason why this journey is so special, not simply to us, but to everyone who participates.
And so you mentioned Spanish. How was the problem of translation solved? Was Spanish the only language you were dealing with? And was it only spoken words that you had to translate?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. One of the problems of doing anthropological fieldwork like this is you have to operate in, obviously, in foreign languages. Now, Spanish is doable, and we both speak Spanish, but the difficulty is learning Nahuatl. And we studied Nahuatl, the Nahuatl language, the language of these people, at Indiana University, where we were both graduate students, and it was taught there. And then we did our own kind of study over the years and gathered vocabulary words and asked people how to say things, and eventually got to the point where we could understand most of what was being said, and we could express ourselves also. But that's always a problem, is getting familiar enough with the language so that you can ask in-depth questions. Now, I will say that in this book, we've also included chanting by the ritual specialists, both the men and the women. And with the help of bilingual informants, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, we were able to transcribe these and translate them into English. So there's 10 chants with the Nahuatl on the left-hand side of the page and the English on the right-hand side of the page. And I will say that to get these 10 chants into accurate English and an accurate translation took us more than 2.5 years of work. So it's very, very difficult.
In fact, that really was a major enterprise, and we were not comfortable doing it on our own. But I would like to mention the names of some of the indigenous participants who have gone into anthropology and other disciplines themselves. Eduardo de la Cruz and his wife, Brisa Zavala, helped us tremendously with the final check of the English translation. Brisa is a trilingual speaker of English, Nahuatl, and Spanish. And Abelardo de la Cruz and his wife, Alberta Martinez Cruz, also cooperated. There's a large Nahuatl language program that they were all affiliated with. So they lent a tremendous effort to it. And one thing Alan didn't mention is the 1998 pilgrimage, we were accompanied by University of Veracruz anthropologists, a few of them, and they brought along a videographer. And that was turns out to be the reason why we were able to do this. When you're participating in and hanging by your toenails on the side of a sacred mountain, you really cannot take time to record. So the videographer captured 10 hours of chanting in a much more comfortable in the setting in the village of Amatlan. And so we were able to use a lot of that material, and that's what appears in the book. Some of the recordings were taken later in the pilgrimage with a handheld video camera. So that problem of translation, as Alan has always mentioned, it's really, really very difficult to capture both colloquial and accurate translations. But we, with the aid of our indigenous helpers, the work is much more polished.
What about European influences? Was the mythos only indigenous?
These people were colonized in the early 16th century. So, of course, there's going to be European influence, mainly Spanish influence, on their religious beliefs and on the language and on all aspects of their lives. But what is absolutely amazing about these pilgrimages is how little influence Spanish has had. Now, they have incorporated, for example, saints that are a subject of some of the offerings and everything. But these saints are matched with indigenous deities very often. So, for example, we will have San Juan, and they'll talk about San Juan. They pronounce it Sawan in Nahuatl, but San Juan is a deity or a divinity of storms and rain. It's a kind of a rain spirit entity. So what they do is they name it with a Spanish name, but the actual content of the divinity itself is largely pre-Hispanic.
What is costumbre? Is that a religion?
Yeah, costumbre is what they call their religion in Spanish. And it's interesting, they call it el costumbre, but in Spanish it should be la costumbre, but they changed the gender marking at the beginning of the word to create the definition of themselves, which stands for their own religion. They have a name for their religion, Tlanatoquili, which means to be worshipful or to be respectful. But they've taken a Spanish name. When you're speaking Spanish to them, they'll call it El Costumbre.
I know Dia de los Muertos was recent. Is that a celebration that you encountered in your research? Or are there things in Mexico today that are historically relevant to the Nahua culture?
Yeah, here in America, North America, we got the Dia de los Muertos probably from the Nahuas. This is a custom that they've had, and it probably undoubtedly traces to the pre-Hispanic period. And Day of the Dead is a very important ritual marking in the ritual calendar for these people. and they set up elaborate altars, and the ritual lasts about 4 days, and they make food offerings, first of all, to the children who died, the spirits of the children who died, and then to the older people who died. And then at the very end, the last day, they go to the graveyard, and they lay out a beautiful feast on the top of the graves of the of their dead relatives. So the whole idea of Day of the Dead actually comes probably from the Nahuas themselves.
That's really interesting. So what about the elements like fire, water, earth, etc.? Are those special? Do they hold significance?
Yeah, very, very much like the ancient Greeks, we have earth, air, fire, and water are the basic elements in our metaphysics. And so you'll see these elements appear in different aspects, different parts of the rituals, and they're chanting and everything all throughout their religious practices. You also find references to it in their complex oral traditions, oral narrations that they tell, the myths that they tell about everything. So it's because it's they basically reflect the metaphysics of the group.
And illustrations take up a vital part of your book. Who were the illustrators? And can you also tell the audience more about your figures, the plates, and the tables that show up in the text?
Yes, the press did an exemplary job designing the book. We worked very closely with a talented compositor, Tina Caccelli, and she did. We worked a long time getting all of the really the illustrations and the drawings of the paper cuttings that we've already mentioned briefly. The artwork. Really, it's religious art. These thousands upon thousands of ephemeral figures cut from paper, handmade paper in the past and in other communities. People may be familiar with some of the Otomi paper figures that we can find. You can find in folk art shops in Mexico, and they're used in Otomi rituals. But related to their practices, the Nahua paper figures are. This is a collection of paper figures prepared for a major pilgrimage like Postecli. And we had an artist, Anna Myers, whose grandparents were Nahuatl speakers. She's was a student at our university and has done illustrations for us for many, many years. And she produced the more than 300 vector drawings that illustrate what is a rare and very unusual opportunity for us to illustrate for people, a complete corpus of cuttings, of figures, of entities, as you mentioned, images of fire, images of water, the spirit entity of water in many different aspects, many aspects of the earth figure. The list is enormous. And again, for a single ritual like this major pilgrimage to Postecli, they would cut tens of thousands of these paper figures and carefully organize them, label them, wrap them in bundles, wrap them up in fresh palm mats, and carry this burden to the tops of the mountains, deploying the paper figures on altars all the way along, multiple repetitions of the offerings. And I can't say enough about both our artists and another friend, an artist from Indiana, Michael Akas, volunteered years ago to draw illustrations of the myth of the corn spirit, seven flower, Chickamashoshit. And his beautiful artwork illustrates that important story. I hope people in Mexico will really appreciate seeing it illustrated. So we'll say more about the paper figures, but those are two of our artists.
Alan, do you have something to add about this?
Well, you know, our names went on as authors of the book. But as a matter of fact, this is a group effort, and there were probably a dozen or more people who really worked very hard to make this become a possibility. And that includes Nahuas themselves, as well as these artists that Pamela just mentioned. And not to mention friends who read the manuscript and helped us to eliminate errors and to smooth out the whole presentation. So it really is a group effort.
And we are seriously thankful that we had this team of people. It really definitely was a group effort. And what we've tried to do, it's we've published many other articles and some books about the sacred paper figures, this incredible complex of paper cutting. And we've attempted many types of analysis. You asked earlier, you know, about the difficulty of translation. Well, it's also extremely difficult to translate or interpret, if you would, the iconography of these paper figures. So we took quite a few different approaches in the book, which we explained. We took all of the drawings and laid them out in a large tabular arrangement. The book includes a fold-out, a folded insert in the back of the book. And kind of like an ancient codex, these rare remnant literature of the ancient Aztecs or Maya, we tried to analyze their iconography and their the possibility of them having a narrative order. So the interpretive work was aided certainly by the fact that the costumbre religion depends on such an incredible body of visual artistic material. We really thought we had a ready-made inventory of the spirit world at our disposal, and we've plumbed it for what we can. I hope that others are be inspired to take that analysis further.
But let me add a little something that I had neglected earlier. Of course, the people who helped us the most are the people in Amatlan, and particularly the ritual specialists. We actually dedicated the book to the head ritual specialist in this region, a guy named Encarnacion Tez Hernandez. His nickname was Cirilo, and Cirilo was extremely helpful and very anxious for us to not only record the chanting, but to take photos and to listen to them tell the myths that underlie these rituals so we could record them, because as we'll talk a little bit later, the Nahuas are undergoing radical change right now because of the economic changes that are going on in Mexico. And their fear was that their religion was going to be lost and rejected by the younger generation. So they wanted it written down. And it was our pleasure to try to do that, which we have done in this book.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Okay, your son Michael came up earlier. Did he contribute to the book Pilgrimage to Broken Mountain?
He did indeed. As Alan pointed out, we also put Michael's Sandstrom's name on the title page. He's an adult now with his own children. He's an architect. He's blended his adventuresome childhood with his talents. He did some beautiful, skilled schematic drawings, diagrams, and maps for the book, illustrating the sacred geography. He illustrated some of the hard to explain, and with the picture's worth a thousand words. He found very, as an architect, he's talented at the drawing, very succinct way to help us synthesize the details and communicate the complex relationships between these elements of their worldview. It certainly has influenced his life. He said it was a significant part influence on his life as well.
Did you guys take home any memorabilia? You mentioned the paper figures. What about adornments? Do you still have any of those items?
We're given collections to take home, as a matter of fact, by Cirilo and his colleagues, his professional colleagues. And he wanted us to show Americans all of this stuff, all of the material he gave us, to show how beautiful his religion is. Now, the paper figures, for the most part, are being housed in museums at the moment. We also have all of the oral narratives we have put in an organization affiliated with the University of Texas called the Archives of the Indigenous Languages of Latin America, which makes these myths available to anybody for free. They are also been transcribed and translated for people. The Nahuas themselves can get access to these. So we brought stuff home, but it's a transition zone from us to put it in museums for permanent storage. and for future scholars to be able to look at.
But there are, I must add, an interesting phenomenon on pilgrimage. In the book, we do look at some other comparative traditions of pilgrimage in Mexico and worldwide, trying to come up with a bit of a deeper understanding to which our empirical ethnographic data could, you know, illuminate the principles behind pilgrimage. And you always take home a souvenir.
Yeah.
And it should be something, and we witness this time and again in each pilgrimage, people would bring home, and we illustrate in the book, some rather large format paper figures. Again, all out of the incredibly fragile material or medium of paper. But they would reinforce the paper figures, these larger ones, with little folded paper bones that they called in Spanish huesitos. And they would dress the paper figures with beautiful cloth dresses and braids of ribbon, jewelry, rings, and all of that. And these were reveal or evoke, they were manifestations of the corn and other elements like earth and water. And these would be taken to the mountain and brought home and kept in people's homes as souvenirs. So that's an excellent question. It does the memorabilia for academics is our research material. And so we're trying to do an analysis. As Alan said, we've stored definitely the Indiana University Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology has a very large collection of our paper figures since 1970, and these pilgrimage materials that are in the book are housed there safely now.
Are there collection materials housed in a more digital humanities format? Can we access these in an online database?
The oral narratives you can through ILA. The paper figures have not been put up on any kind of digital format at all. You'd have to actually go to the museums probably to study them.
But we published a book and we're privileged to be able to include all these illustrations. So I think this really is a place for people to see them. Obviously, they can be viewed in a PDF version of the book and examined much more closely. The photographs actually in that format, an ebook, are pretty spectacular, to be honest.
And as Pamela mentioned, our previous publications very often contain reproductions of these paper figures.
We are working on archiving these just for that reason. But again, this is sacred art. This is not material that probably should be necessarily visible or misused for, you know, commercial reasons or anything like that. So we are a little bit reticent right now to publish them.
Make
them available in that way. But we are very pleased if people will make good use of the audio material.
And do you mind going back to help your audience understand some of your previous writings and how they might be related to the new book that you have now?
No, we have I think a number of books, more than six books, and I don't know, 50 or 60 book chapters and journal articles. So it's quite a large body of material. Most of it's available through online and in some format, I think.
Internet Archive contains two of our books. Our first book on the paper figure complex of the Nahua, Otomi, and Tepewa ritual specialists. It was called Traditional Papermaking and Paper Cult Figures. University of Oklahoma Press published it, but we have a freely accessible Internet Archive edition of that. Also, Alan's book, published by Oklahoma in 1991, Corn is Our Blood, is available in Spanish edition, and the English edition is also freely accessible on Internet Archive.
Right. So we're doing what we can to spread the word.
What about the rural village that you did visit? So Nahua culture, is it something that is alive in the broader Mexican landscape, or is it isolated?
The village itself, I think we would call isolated, but Nahua culture is not restricted to that one village. It's found all over Mexico. It's influenced a number of areas of Mexican national life. There are about 2 to 2.5 million speakers of the Nahuatl language, and they're spread all the way from North Mexico down to Nicaragua. So it's a large number of people. The language, by the way, is related to Native American languages spoken in the American Southwest, languages like Ute, Paiute, Comanche, Shoshone, and Hopi. So it's a related language and probably originated in the American Southwest and then moved down into Mexico, a millennia or two ago.
Do we find Nahua culture in America, particularly from like Southern California to other parts of the Southwest?
Well, the latest understanding is that the American Southwest and Central Mexican cultures are highly related to each other. And this is something that's fairly recent in our understanding. So you would find traits that in Nahuatl culture found in Mexico, probably in the American Southwest. But the Nahuas have also influenced daily life for a lot of us. They're the ones who gave us tomatoes, for example. They gave us the word tomato, tomate. They gave us avocados, including the word awokat. They gave us chocolate. The word chocolate is a Nahuatl word. So they've influenced, their influence goes far beyond their Mexican homeland.
And how far back does Nahuatl history go? For a historian, they might want to understand some things the anthropologists are describing, but they want to look at it from a more chronological perspective. How would they do that?
Well, the group that is most famous that most people have heard of are the Aztecs, and the Aztecs were Nahuas. And so there's an enormous body of written records on the Aztecs after the 1521 Spanish conquest. And there's an industry of ethnohistorians and archaeologists who are looking at Aztec culture and Aztec record keeping. Many of the records, by the way, are in the Nahuatl language. So to do this work, you have to know Nahuatl. You have to know it really well. And we trace it back to the Aztecs. There is also the previous civilization called the Toltecs that the Aztecs actually admired and looked back to. And those were also Nahuatl speakers, but they left very few records. What we know about the Toltecs largely comes from Aztec the people themselves who recall them and told myths about them. And the Spaniards wrote a lot of this down. And of course they go back further than that, but that record is only available to archaeology.
Are there any special archaeological methods that you guys employed?
We are not archaeologists. We are cultural anthropologists. I will say though that throughout all of Amatlan and throughout the entire southern Huasteca are ruins from previous civilizations that lived there. There was a Maya civilization lived there called the Huastec people. They call themselves the Tinec. And they're very separate. It's a small separate group that's very much separated from the main body of Maya down south into Yucatan, into Guatemala. And they left ruins all over the region. The Nahua still do offerings and rituals on top of ancient platform mounds that were built pre-Hispanically, prehistorically. So the history is all around them.
Are there any specific oral traditions that you learned while you were there?
Well, let me just say that we spent a lot of time recording oral traditions, and we, as I say, they are available through the ILA organization at the University of Texas. And they have a very complex a myth system that involves history of corn, the history of the local community. It involves the water and involves our relationship to the ecological factors. It's a complex, extremely interesting body of oral narrations. They've also incorporated into this stories that were told by traveling merchants from Europe. And so we have a beautiful Nahuatl version of Hansel and Gretel. They've modified the story a little bit to make it more comprehensible, but they've incorporated some of the more interesting European stories that were brought to them by these traveling merchants over the last 500 years.
And one thing to add too is the reason we include the five traditional stories or myths, really part of their mythic traditions, oral traditions in the book, is to try to explain something of the worldview, because this is how actually people learn and share their understanding of it. The stories definitely circulate around their ethical system of respect and reciprocity, and explain in many ways, and they are the clue for us to understand the ritual practices that aim to restore a world that is in constant flux and to help restore equilibrium and balance. So you can get to that through the oral traditions and by observing the rituals. That's why our focus on religion and the approach that we've taken to understand their statements about it and their practice and observe closely their behavior. That's why this it's kind of a multi-method and multimedia approach that we've taken, but we're very, very much focused on explaining the point of view of the Nahua practitioners as to why they do these pilgrimages and keep their costumbre traditions alive.
Do you challenge scientific approaches to anthropology in this work by focusing on religion and pantheism?
No, we find we are supporters of the anthropological approach in anthropology, and we extend this scientific approach in order to better understand the religious system. The topic religion is comprehensible in a scientific way. We think we even have insights into the causations of the factors that cause a religion like this to develop. So we're very much in the scientific tradition, and we don't see religion or ritual as outside of the scope of science.
And is it possible to take a more agnostic or atheistic look at the Nahua people?
Yeah, we are documenting this religious system and their practices and beliefs. But you have to, it's really important to understand that not all Nahua go along with this. There are Nahua agnostics and Nahua atheists, as well as there are agnostics and atheists in our own society. We go in there as neutral observers, but we've learned to develop an incredible level of respect for their religious beliefs and their system of offerings. We think they are, you can really learn a lot from them, and that would help actually improve our own lives.
Then let's transition into the topic of rituals. Did the people you visited include sacrifices of living creatures?
These are the Nahua, as Alan has Nahua people, as Alan has clearly pointed out, are descendants of the Aztec and ancient cultures, who did, we know, practice human sacrifice. Today, the sacrifice is of chickens and turkeys. So the sacrificial fowl do play a part. Blood is an offering of the highest order, along with all the other things that people treasure, the food and beautiful flowers, and altars are an amazing thing. But these are the descendants of the Aztecs, and there is blood sacrifice. It's done, as Alan mentioned, too, that the importance of respect and reciprocity with the spirit world. What is happening with the blood offering is it is the source of power and vitality. It's what animates a living thing. And by sacrificing and using the blood of a sacrificial fowl, the food is consumed later. That's for sure. They're dispatched swiftly without any kind of torture or anything like that. They're cooked. The meat is eaten afterwards. But the chikobalisli is the word they use for the power or the energy that comes from blood. So yeah, it's hard in a short answer to explain how sacrifice can be justified. It does seem perhaps to people as an unnecessary cruel element. But you know, religions worldwide have all had an element of sacrifice. And you only have to think of European religions and their relationship to, blood sacrifice to understand that. So I think that's all we can really add. We address the question of blood and the power that comes from blood and why this is done in the book very, very carefully.
Alan, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I guess, thanks for the opportunity. When we hear about the Aztecs, the thing that pops into people's minds immediately is human sacrifice. And I would never justify it, and Pamela would never justify it. And it's, you know, from my perspective, it's very distasteful and awful. But put it in context. In the 16th century, the Spaniards, who felt they were so superior to the Aztecs, were murdering hundreds of thousands of people in the Inquisition at that same time. So if you put it in perspective a little bit, it's not quite so anomalous.
Warfare. You must have encountered this topic in your time there. Was there a fight or war that came up during your research of the Nahua people?
That's an excellent question. Right on the heels of human sacrifices, Aztec warfare. So, I mean, these themes need to be addressed. We do not report on any relationship of the rituals to warfare in the sense that you maybe are thinking. Today, drug wars in Mexico have seriously interfered with the quality of life of not just the indigenous people in the communities in the outback. It's a terrible, terrible trial. Land of battles and all of that are constantly threatening people's safety and security. What we can say, though, on a different, slightly different angle about the idea of warfare is that the ritual specialists, I would say, and we do write about this, are clearly warriors on behalf of their entire community, not only their individual clients or as curers trying to heal people, but they behave very much like a dignified warrior. And so that's a precarious role that a ritual specialist takes on. Both men and women are clearly heroic and respected for that kind of combative approach to countering the forces of disorder or disequilibrium or human suffering. So there's no question that they are truly respected. I think that ties it back to perhaps how the Aztecs regarded warriors. It's an interesting question and an interesting subject to pay attention to.
Yeah, it's sometimes not understood, the self-sacrifice involved in becoming a ritual specialist. You're dealing with these dangerous forces your whole life, and there's always the possibility that you might be using your skills against people. So several of the ritual specialists that we've known over the years have gotten themselves killed. On suspicion of using their powers against people. It's quite a dangerous occupation, actually.
And what were some of the occupations of the Nahua people that you want to mention?
These are corn farmers. They grow corn, beans, and squash using no animal power or mechanical power. It's all human effort. And It's gardening, essentially. It's milpa horticulture, and they also raise some farm animals, chickens and turkeys. And the wealthier members of the community might have a cow or a head or two of cattle.
If you had to change anything about your journey, what would it be?
Well, I can speak for myself. The one thing I would like to do is to continue the work down there. It's an incredible, life-changing adventure. And to be able to meet and talk to these people is awe-inspiring. It's an amazing experience. And so every chance we got over the years, we would go down there, even if it was just for a week or two. But we try to at least pencil out a year to spend with them. And so it's just every time you go down there, you learn something completely new. You learn a whole new way to look at the world. So it's really an amazing experience.
The success that we have managed to have in completing these projects, we've always had an agenda and a research proposal to take a year from your teaching and librarianship work. You have to justify your leave. So a sabbatical usually did have a strong focus, and so. Recording oral narratives was the focus of 1 year, documenting horticultural practices and the use of changes in crops and patio animals and more of an economic anthropology strategy study, was a focus. So I do think the...
Nathan, one thing I could mention here, it's sort of an aside, but the people often ask about the paper that's used in the cutting. And what did the people do in the pre-Hispanic days before the Spaniards got there? And in fact, the paper making is an ancient tradition in Mesoamerica. They made paper basically out of the inner bark of various fig trees and also from the maguey plant. And they would tap out these sheets of paper on these flat boards and dry them in the sun. And they became thick like parchment. And this paper was used by the Aztecs, we know from the historic, from the Spaniard records of the Spaniards. And they used them for priest costumes, for banners and flags that they flew, and for divination and all kinds of things. It was one of the main items of tribute that was shipped to the Aztec capitals from the provinces, from the tribute empire. Millions and millions of sheets of this handmade paper were brought into the Aztec capital every year. Now today, the people still make paper. You can still see it, but it's a lot of work. And so what they do as a sort of a workaround is they go to the markets and they buy paper. And there's three basic kinds of paper they use. They use a kind of a newsprint, which of course doesn't last very long if you're trying to store it. They use a tissue paper that's colored for certain dangerous wind spirits. And they use a polished paper called papel lustre for the permanent seed figures that they cut and they keep in everybody's house. So paper is an important part of this thing, but they have modernized and they're using paper they buy in the market these days for their paper figures.
What about altar traditions? Was the Nahua traditional practice communal or was it more individualistic?
I can address that, I think. It's definitely communal. These are dozens and dozens of people interrupt their lives to help make the altar adornments and to participate in these rituals. It's a lot of camaraderie. They're a lot of fun, actually. And they go on day and night, by the way. There's no rest. So you can have a ritual going on for 10 days, 12 days without any rest at all for anybody. And there's lots of food and there's offerings that are dedicated. I would like to point out, by the way, that the altar is set up in a kind of an interesting way. It has an arch over it. There's a table as the main altar. There's an arch over it. And they put offerings on top of the table and beneath the table. So you've got an arch with offerings on the table and offerings underneath. And what this does is it embodies the three-tiered levels of the cosmos, the sky, the earth's surface, and the underworld. So they're actually modeling the cosmos in these rituals on these altars.
These altars are beautiful. They're made to be beautiful. They put a lot of effort into it, covered with fresh flowers and greenery. And they are seats of exchange with the spirit entities or the divinities that are addressed in the form of these paper figures. We can't stress enough how important reading the paper figures is to understanding what they're trying to accomplish through the ritual and the design of their altars. It's an amazing and complex phenomenon.
Veracruz, can you give your audience a better description of the natural habitat?
Yeah, it's, I think I mentioned earlier, it's the foothills of the Sierra Madres. It's tropical. It's very hot. There's lots of, everything is up and down. Villages have reached or markets by trails. So you've got to cross bodies of water constantly. It has beautiful tropical birds like parrots are there. It has alligators in the streams that you once in a while you run into. It has iguanas. It has huge tarantulas that come out at night and on the ground. And you will see them. The tarantulas are so big that they catch mice, actually. And you'll see a tarantula run across the ground outside of a house with a mouse in its mouth and go into a hole that it made. So and there's also snakes. There's poisonous snakes. There's a snake called a fertilance, which is extremely deadly, and the people are afraid of them, and they do occasionally bite somebody. So as Pamela said, there's a saying about the Huasteca, which is this area where we work, even the butterflies bite. And so people, the outsiders have kept away from it, which I think has partly been responsible for allowing these ancient traditions to continue to this day.
When were you most nervous on this trip?
I was most nervous on this trip when we were clinging by our toenails and fingernails to the side of a 2,000-foot mountain. It was awe-inspiring and hair-raising. The trail sometimes straight down would be about a foot wide, and you'd have to progress very carefully. We've gone on this trek twice, as Alan said, in 1998 and again in 2001. And first time during extreme heat, and things were afire. We're getting used to wildfires now, but it was unusual back in 1998 to have the air filled with smoke. And that was worldwide in 1998. 2001, it was the beginning of the rainy season. So it was a slippery, muddy mess. And there were lots of centipedes, millipedes that are bad to touch. And there are places on the hill where you have to hold on to a rope and just ascend through handhold and toe holds all the way up. But I wasn't deterred, and neither was Alan. Neither was our son, Michael. He thought that was an adventure. And there were plenty of people our age now going on this trek. So I just kept my fears to myself.
I will say that you have this foot-wide ledge in the rock that goes a quarter of the way around this gigantic boulder, really, is what it is. It's the center of a volcano, and you've got to hold on. By the way, you're carrying a big load up there. You're carrying the offerings. You're carrying chickens and turkeys sometimes, and you have to hold on with your hands. And a slip, it would be a 1,000-foot drop. And sometimes across your hand as you're holding, a tropical centipede would crawl, and you could not let your hand go to get the centipede off of you. So that's probably the most dangerous and nerve-wracking part of the trip.
Everybody wants to know about the bugs, but, you know, really, it's kind of the ethnographic field research covers a lot of a broad range of territory. There are a lot of pleasures of being in the field as well, and good camaraderie and companionship, but people do focus on the uncomfortable.
Nasty bugs.
Yep.
What other pilgrimages from around the world most resemble the Nahua? It could be the pilgrimage to Mecca or some other trek.
The pilgrimages are actually found in virtually every culture in the world. This is part, one of the things we learned in writing this book. The pilgrimages that most resemble the Nahua are from other Native American groups. This is very commonly found in throughout North, South, and Middle America. The American Southwest is filled with pilgrimage routes. The Andes are filled with pilgrimage routes and often associated with sacred mountains. So this Nahua pilgrimage is not an unusual or weird thing at all. It's found virtually everywhere.
If you could go on another pilgrimage, where would you go?
Back up to the top of one of those sacred mountains.
Absolutely.
I would love to do it again. I'm sorry that the political situation is such that it would not be a safe thing. And we imagine, and some of our indigenous colleagues are certainly able to travel there, you know, with care and visit their families. So the ritual practices are ongoing. I'm sorry that we can't be part of it right now.
And what about your retirement? Do you still involve yourself with your previous school, university? And what work are you doing now to keep up to date?
Well, that's a good question. We both retired in 2010, a long time ago. And one of the reasons was to be able to apply ourselves to publishing this work, this and other work that we've been, we're organizing. All of our data, we're making sure that all of our field materials are available for future scholars, and we're continuing to publish. So we do a lot of reading and we do a lot of writing, and being free from the teaching and administrative constraints has allowed us to make a lot of progress on this. I will say, however, as I will repeat, that this particular book was a labor of love, and we took 8 full years to write it, to gather the information, and to get it published.
Any final thoughts for your audience from Alan or Pamela?
Well, final thoughts are always an open end for another conversation, actually. One thing that Alan and I both feel very strongly, that though this took us a very long time, the output of the book was gratifying and successful. We do hope it gets a good reception and other people will find avenues for new research in it. The message that we ended the book with was that the solutions that the Nahua people and their indigenous neighbors, the other cultures of Mesoamerica, have found ways to solve a lot of the crisis in the world. We are certainly embroiled in political and ecological crises of existential, dimension. And I think it's very helpful if we would look at the way other people and other cultures have solved problems. If we would only take the trouble to learn, it's clearly the anthropological message. So we have contributed this work to that. It's empirical information that I hope will be well used.
I would add to that just sort of a summary statement that the people mm-hmm. of the world have a lot to teach us. If we just took the time to learn, much of Nahua religion would benefit the most advanced modern economies of the world today, which is deal with the ecological factors with respect, don't take more than you need, keep a balance going, keep equilibrium, and focus on your social life and your community.
You listened to an original podcast recording of the New Books Network and your host, Nathan Moore. Our audience can thank Alan and Pamela Sandstrom for contributing an episode about their book, Pilgrimage to Broken Mountain, Nahua's Sacred Journeys in Mexico's Huasteca Veracruzana. I'm your host, Nathan Moore. Until next time, and farewell.